You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Hello, everyone. On today's episode, I have a phenomenal story for you. We're actually getting the opportunity to speak with Court. Her wife, Nick, and their daughter, Finn, have been on this path to financial independence, achieving, working through actually some pretty remarkable obstacles, including nearly six figures of student loan debt, and actually achieving financial independence in their very early 30s. So I'm very excited about this episode. And to help me with this, I have my co-host, Brad, here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan. I'm doing quite well. Yeah, this should be a fascinating episode. I'm curious to hear Court's background on growing up in the US and now living in Canada and seeing essentially both sides of this equation. And I love that she considers herself a valuist. Their family spends under $25,000 annually, but does not feel deprived in any way. And that just jumped off the page to me. So really, really excited to discuss this. And with that, Court, welcome to Choose FI.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So $25,000 a year, like was that, where? How did we get to that number as our steady state number?
Sure. So we have certain fixed costs that make up the bulk of our annual spend. And we've really just figured out a way to eliminate the fluff, eliminate the things that don't matter to us, and only focus on the things that actually bring us joy and bring us value. And those are the things that we'll spend on. Other things we just don't buy. Like there's just so many things out there. Advertising and marketing and our consumerist culture just pushes down your throat essentially to buy, buy, buy. And we've just kind of figured out a way to eliminate that trap from our life. So we enjoy eating great food, but my wife loves cooking. So we cook probably 95% of our food at home and we'll go out to eat maybe once a month. Things like that, we use our cars are used low mileage, reliable cars. So we've never had a car payment in our life. We've also house hacked. So that was big. Back when we were living in Florida, we bought a house for $169,000 US. It was a foreclosure during the crazy foreclosure mayhem, which I know impacted so many people negatively. We were on the opposite side of that. We took the gains from that craziness. And we basically bought this 4-bedroom townhouse and had 3 roommates living with us. And they were paying way more than our mortgage payment. So they were able to pay for our mortgage within 2.5 years. We were contributing a little more on top of that, plus what we were getting from our roommates. And our mortgage was gone in 2.5 years. So the housing side of things has never been an issue really for us. With that, when we moved to Canada, we kept our house down in Florida. We rented it out to a family for 2 years. And they were obviously, that money was now just being fed into us. When you net all expenses, we were making about $900 a month US with that. And of course, we're now in Canada where we have the US Canadian exchange rate to our favor. So right now it's sitting around 1.3, 1.35, the US Canadian exchange rate. So we were getting that monthly hassle-free pretty much. But we realized that being across the continent, we're now in Calgary, so we're in Western Canada. So we were literally across the continent and just the control freak in me had a tough time holding on to that property. So we ended up selling it for 2 years later and we sold it for a nice profit. So all of that money combined from the house really helped eliminate any sort of future house costs in Canada. The house we bought up here was a bit more expensive than what we bought in Florida, but the mortgage was completely covered by our Florida housing. So the big three, right? Housing, car, and food are the big three things that tend to make up the majority of people's expenses. And we just kind of hacked our way through those things, through dealing with those three things, right? And then the rest of the stuff is pretty menial. You know, we don't have TV, we don't have cable, brings us no joy, but we do have annual passes to the sports center and annual ski passes and annual national park passes and annual zoo passes and you name it. Like, it's not like we're living, you know, this deprived life in any sense. You know, we've just figured out what brings us joy and eliminated the rest.
Wow, that's quite a story. I'm sure we can dive into a bunch of these things, but I want to talk about this process of determining what brings you joy and, like you said, cutting out the fluff. Was this an overt process that you and Nick went through, or was it something that just evolved over years by happenstance? Like, do you remember a time where you sat down and had a discussion about cutting certain items or finding what you value? Did you write out lists of things? Like, talk me through the actual process of this. Or were you just luckily on the same page from the very first?
Yeah, we were very lucky to both have the same mindset and mentality. And I think honestly, it's the mindset that's the biggest thing to reaching financial independence. You know, you can make $200,000, but if you're spending all $200,000, you're never going to get there, right? So I think we're both just naturally savers. And a lot of it, I think, had to do with both of us had student loan debt getting out of school. So I had about $70,000 to my name. Nick had about $40,000 to her name. So combined, we had $110,000 in student loan debt. And both of us are just extremely debt averse. You know, we would never go to our parents and ask for handouts or anything like that. So we had a mission, both of us. This was before we even met each other. We met each other after school, that we wanted to get rid of our debt ASAP. So when I started my first job out of school, I was paying over $1,000 a month from my paycheck into my student loans, even though the minimal payments was, you know, a couple hundred dollars. I was just supercharging that. And so I was still living the pretty frugal college minimalist life. I lived right across the street from my job. I just walked in within 6 minutes. I had locked my door and I was sitting at my desk. So I didn't have a commute. I was living with roommates. You know, I was doing kind of everything that I had been doing in college just to get rid of this debt. And then once that was done, I think that created that mindset. So while I never wish anyone gets burdened with student debt, like, it actually played this positive role in my life, as weird as it sounds to say that, getting rid of that was just number one. And I think that just ingrained this mentality of never, ever wanting to be in debt ever again. And so the next step after that, I didn't know what I was doing in terms of investing. You know, I was reaching my company, a 401k match at that time. And I think I was investing maybe 10% of my income into my 401k, but everything else was going towards the student loans. Like, so I was riding my bike. I had a scooter. So my gas, I think, was like $4 a tank to fill it up. You know, I also had a car, but I never really drove it because I didn't need to. You know, I lived by the beach, so I would go there. And, you know, I was living a fun, happy life. I also learned about travel hacking. That was huge for us. We love traveling. We love exploring and learning about new cultures. So in the past 10 years, you know, we've been to over 25 countries and have done extensive travel. So it's not like we're living, again, this deprived life. But to go back to your question, I think, you know, having that debt on my name, to my name, was the driving force to live this way. And then once that debt was gone, it was just like, okay, now what can I do with this excess money? Since I wasn't spending it on consumerism things anyways, it was going towards my student loans. Then the next step was saving for a down payment for a house. Then we bought that house and then we were investing. So it was just like, where do I put this money? Because I was used to not spending it in the first place.
So you and Nick both had pretty significant student loan debt that you were able to pay off. And I'm just curious, you know, tactically early on in your career, what was the communication like that allowed you to kind of work on this together? And how were you able to create enough space to pay off all of that student loan debt so quickly?
Yeah, sure. So when we first started dating, I had already paid off my student loan debt. So I had paid it off within 2.5 years after graduating. around that time is when I met Nick. So I didn't have any more debt to my name. And at that point, I was saving for a down payment for our house. So that's where I was at in my stage in my life. And Nick, luckily, like she's just very frugal too. Like when she moved, she went to university in Rhode Island and then came down to Florida for her second degree. And she just put everything that she owned in her car. And that's what made it down to Florida. That's what she was, that was her life, you know? And so she was living in a one bedroom, I can't even call it a studio. It was a box. Like it was this tiny room. Like it was a combination of a bed slash, I wouldn't even call it a mini kitchen, you know, and a closet and a little bathroom. And that was her living situation when she moved down here. And that was a decision she had made, you know, not with us talking. So clearly we both are aligned and like, it didn't make sense for her to go into more debt to have a nice one bedroom apartment in Miami, because it was be, you know, way more costly than what this was. I don't even know what to call this, you know, but we were both aligned, like not spending money we didn't have, you know? And so when she was in school, she knew like I'm taking out debt to get my second degree at this point. Like I'm not going to go into further debt for this. And so when she eventually moved in with me, there wasn't really that many crazy conversations that had to be had. You know, we were both on the same wavelength and it was just decided, you know, she would just concentrate on paying off her debt. And we basically split all of our other sort of expenses, but our expenses were low, right? So she was able to crush her debt also within 2.5 years. So within 2.5 years, we each respectively killed our student loans, which is pretty unheard of. You know, when you talk to anyone else, they have the plan for, you know, the government to pay them off or, you know, down the road and, you know, go through different, not that that's everyone's situation, you know, but no one thinks of 2.5 years, I'm going to get rid of $70,000 or $40,000 in debt. Like that's just not most people's mindset. So I think it was just something ingrained in both of us, like separately. I've always been, you know, more vocal, I guess, with the FIRE concept and financial independence and this idea of, you know, hey, if we just save this much money, we never have to work again. She's just more on the path of like, yeah, just tell me what I need to do and let's do it. You know, like she's not the number cruncher. I'm definitely the number cruncher of the two of us, but there's never been an argument of like, oh no, I really wanted to buy that BMW. Like now I'm feeling like, you know, we're at odds here. Let's have a deep conversation about this. Like it's never been like that for us. It's just come pretty naturally, luckily for both of us. And I understand like that's kind of unheard of, but we're just weirdos like that, I guess.
Wonderfully weird.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So, Cord, I'm struck here and very curious to hear about the inception of this 70K debt. Clearly, you're someone who, in her early to mid-20s, decided, I'm going to pay this thing off as quickly as possible. It sounds like you were locked in so young, but yet you incurred the $70,000 of debt.
Yeah.
Was it a different mindset? Was it like Jonathan who said, I'm going to be a pharmacist. I'm going to come out making $100,000+. It's worth it to incur this debt. Like, where were you at 17 versus 22, 23? And was there a point that it actually shifted for you?
There definitely was a point. I can't pinpoint when. 17-year-old me just wanted to play hockey. That was it. That was all I cared about. I was at a prep school in Vermont for my senior year of school. Money was no concept to me. I was spoiled. Like I never had to even think about money. I never had, you know, the great chats with my parents about how to be frugal or anything like that. I was raised in a middle to upper class neighborhood where, you know, my parents provided for my brother and I kind of in any way we needed, especially when it came to sports. So sports was just my life, essentially. My goal was just to play Division I hockey. That was it. I didn't care where to an extent.
let's calm down then.
Let's be reasonable.
Yeah. But I just wanted to play hockey in college. That was it. And so I was recruited to play Division I hockey. And, you know, I checked out a couple different schools and I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point. I just wanted to play hockey. I thought I was going to be an engineer. And I actually enrolled into the school I went to, into their engineering program. And within a day, I enrolled out of it. I was all over the place. Like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I changed my major a couple times within school. So it's not like I had this path that this is going to be the best major for me to get me the best career for the highest paying job. That was nowhere in my brain at all. I've just always been really good with numbers. So math and science has definitely been my strong points, whereas I avoided taking English classes like the plague when I was in school. So, and I did. I only had to take one, luckily. So I didn't really know where I was going in life. And that's why I went into my master's program. This was in 2008, when we all know what happened in 2008. There were no jobs. Everyone was going back to school. And I thought, well, I'll go and get my master's so it gives me more time to figure things out. And I went back to Florida. I was actually living with one of my friends that I've known forever since I was like a year old. She was down there as well for school. And I wasn't just her roommate. Like, I contacted her. She already had a roommate. And I asked if I can share her bed, as weird as that sounds. Like, that's how close we were. But like, I paid a significantly low amount of rent, because at that point, that's when I realized I have all this debt. Like, I have all these student loans that I need to take care of. At that point, it was $40,000 for my undergrad. And then it was another 25-ish for additional living expenses and my master's degree and things along that lines. I did a term abroad during my undergrad degree. And again, I didn't realize what it was going to cost me until school was all said and done for my bachelor's. So sometime around the end of my bachelor's degree, when I realized, oh, wow, like, I have this student loans, like, how am I going to deal with this? And so in my master's degree, while I was up there, I was literally sharing a bed with my friend. Like, we were very different sleep schedules. I go to sleep very early. She was a night owl and stayed up late. So it's never like we were going to bed together, but it was awkward. Like, don't get me wrong, but I, I was in this mindset though of like, that's when it hit me that like, I need to figure something out. And then luckily I was so blessed to be able to get a job while I was still finishing up my master's, which was at the end of 2018. I did an accelerated program and I started work a week later at the beginning of January of 2009. So I know that is kind of unheard of. And so I just took that little piece of knowledge that like, hey, I have an actually a good paying job, when a lot of my friends who have these bachelor's degree from an excellent private liberal arts college who are now stuck working at Starbucks, you know, or a lot of my friends ended up having to go and live back at home. And I was so grateful that I wasn't in that situation. And so I think that's when it really clicked of like, hey, you need to take advantage of the situation you're in and be able to pay off these student loans, because some of my friends ended up in over $200,000 in student loan debt because they kept going for another degree and another degree and another degree, right? Because there was no jobs out there. So I knew that I was in a very good situation and I had to take advantage of it.
All right. So there's several things there. One is this extreme need to pay off the student loans, which I'm still trying to figure out where exactly that came from, because you didn't really have a lot of concern about taking it out. It's kind of like, oh, wow, the payments are real. All right. Well, I got to get rid of it tomorrow, which that's amazing. And then there's, I will do whatever it takes. And if, you know, to create that space. So I'm curious, like, when you look at the job that you were in from an ROI perspective, what field did you end up getting into? Is there anything there that like is something that now looking back at your career trajectory, you would advise for someone else from an ROI perspective? And then also, I'm so impressed at that ruthless saying, all right, I will do whatever it takes to make my life cost zero for this period of time while I throw everything I have at the student loan debt. And I guarantee you, you'll always look back and say, man, I'm so glad I didn't just look at what it would take to get student loan forgiveness, because you carve out, you free yourself from decades of payments.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was an economics and math major. That was my undergrad degree. And then my master's was in international business. It was an MBA focused on international business. Up until that point, travel had always been my passion. So my senior thesis in my undergrad was travel related, travel and tourism related. And when I chose my master's degree, I chose it in international business, thinking I was going to end up in the travel and tourism industry. That's just what I thought. But then again, like 2008 comes and there's no jobs, right? So I ended up going to a job fair at the University of Florida. That's where I went for my master's. And there was an energy company there that had a business rotation program. There are actually a couple companies that were there with a business rotation program. And that appealed to me. Again, I still didn't really know what I wanted to do in my life. So I like the idea of these rotation programs where you can work for this company, you're getting paid, but you're basically rotating into a couple different departments at the beginning to get a feel for what's the best suit for you. And I really liked that allure. Like, I had no ties to the energy industry at all. I couldn't tell you, you know, any sort of the technical terms when it comes to the energy fields, but I just liked the idea of the rotation program. And so I applied to this job, and luckily, like, it was the first one. It was the first company I applied to. It was the first company I heard back from wanting an interview. It was the only interview I did in 2008 and got it. Like, that's just unheard of, right? When you think of 2008, 2009, and all the people having to try and find jobs there. So I just landed in the energy industry and not knowing anything about it, but it's been like a blessing in disguise. I mean, I've learned so much about the energy industry as a whole. I was on the renewable energy side. So I really like the idea, you know, of wind, solar, storage, and, you know, just the future and sustainability and all that. And after that rotation, I ended up as a trader, an energy trader. I didn't know what that was. It was just like, hey, there's an opening here. Like, after my rotation was done, you like this department. I wasn't in that specific role when I was rotating through that department, but it was shift work, which I really like the idea of shift work. Not many people work shift work, maybe, you know, nurses, firefighters, police officers, whatever, but I never thought I'd end up one in the energy industry and two as a shift worker. And so that opened up the ability to travel a lot. So I've been an energy trader now for, 7-8 years. I took a detour doing something else. I ended up coming back to being an energy trader, doing shift work. So it gives me this work-life balance, and that's the thing that I crave. That's the thing that I love. I've never worked more than 40-hour average work weeks. You know, once I leave work, I never have to check my emails. I'm just totally able to escape away from work because someone else is there doing my exact same job, right? So I am able to travel a lot. And so I would contact friend A, let's say, who only has 2, maybe 3 weeks of vacation. Be like, hey, I've got, you know, 2 weeks off. Let's go to Costa Rica. And we'd book a trip. And then I'd reach out to another friend who only had 2 weeks off and be like, hey, let's go to Europe. And we would book a trip to Europe. And, you know, so on and so on and so on. This was before I even met Nick. And then Nick is a nurse. So she's a shift worker as well. So we just were able to combine our schedules and just travel a lot. And so that's what made work so enjoyable, was like the time off that we got from it.
You know, it's so interesting. I actually had someone recently, and I've thought about it twice. It was Robert Brokamp from The Motley Fool when he interviewed us. He said, the financial independence movement is one of the reasons that this has become so prominent is that so many people find themselves entirely dissatisfied with their chosen profession, with their chosen career. And I couldn't entirely write that off. And so I always find it interesting when someone tells me that they have reached financial independence in a job that they love. They may be leaving it, they may not be leaving it, but they're telling me, this just fed into the life that I wanted to build. Like, those are the things that I like to slow down on. And so I would kind of be curious, like, for our audience that is not, they have never looked into shift work, they've never looked into energy trading. What is energy trader? What does that mean? And then specifically, we said shift work, but practically speaking, what does that mean for the uninitiated?
Sure. I'll talk on the energy side to start. So I'm a real-time energy trader. So right now, energy cannot be stored. Once it is generated and created by whatever generation facility, be it natural gas, wind, nuclear, it has to go somewhere. So whether it's being created in a small rural area, which is typical, it then goes on the transmission grid to the load centers, cities, you know, wherever they may be. And it doesn't have to be, you know, in this geographical one little area. So that's where my role as a real-time trader comes in. I work on the West Coast region. I look for different opportunities of different areas that have either very high or very low prices. And I try and move that power to another region basically by buying the transmission that's needed to bring that power to a different region where I can either buy it low, let's say in Seattle area during the spring when there's a lot of hydro there, and I bring that power down into California, let's say, for example, where there's more demand. And so essentially that is my job. And so every hour I am looking for these different opportunities. So that's my job kind of in a nutshell. I basically find the power, find the transmission path to get it from A to B and piece it together and try and do a better job than any other company out there, essentially, right?
Well, of course, yeah. So the shift work, like what does that mean practically? Are you saying you get to work 8 hours at a time, 10 hours at a time? Like you only have to work a certain number of shifts per month? Like how, I know you're able to take you have an incredible amount of time that you can be flexible with, but how do you obtain that time and why? I mean, I understand now why it's so valuable, but you know, why does shift work give you this?
Sure. So I work 12-hour shifts. They're 6 to 6, either 6 a.m. to 6 at night or 6 at night to 6 in the morning. So not many people can handle the crazy shifts. And that's those type of people are in this role for about a year and a half, and then they leave. They're just like, the shifts are not meant for me. However, if you are able to deal with these crazy 12-hour shifts, you don't leave this job because you get so much time off. If you can handle the days that you're a zombie and when you're on shift, the time off makes it so worth it. So right now I'm actually working part-time. That's part of our fire journey. While I was working full-time, essentially I had over the course of the year, 10 different chunks of 7 to 14 days off, give or take, plus other time off in between. But those were like my larger chunks of time off, as I had 10 of those over the course of the year. Now I work part-time and my schedule is honestly like so amazing. I work 3 or 4 shifts in a row and then I have 2 weeks off on repeat. So it comes out to 20 different chunks of 2 weeks off over the year. So I have 40 weeks off over the year. I work 73 days out of a 365-day calendar. I did the math. You know, I'm off 80% of the days of the year.
All right. You know?
So the typical, I work 50% right now. The typical shift worker works double that. So they're in the office probably closer, you know, 40% of the days of the year. So because you have longer days in the office, you have more days away from the office. There are longer hours, of course, but you have more days off completely away from being in the office. I had been working full-time off of shift work for 2.5 years. And I was doing the whole Monday through Friday grind. And going to that job, I was actually really, really, really hesitant because I had been doing shift for 6.5 years at that point. And I love the schedule. You know, my body was starting, it was starting to wear on me. I wasn't sleeping as great. So that was ultimately what led me to leave the shift world. But then I'm doing this Monday through Friday, you know, with your, I had 3 weeks off of vacation a year. I'm like, I'm never off. Like, how are you supposed to go do doctor's appointments or, you know, do anything, grocery store? I was used to doing that, you know, on a Tuesday at 8 o'clock in the morning or on a Friday at 2, you know, and so just that shift, I did that for a couple years and then the shift world brought me right back in, but I came back to it in a part-time role as we transitioned to fire. So we've reached FI for our family of 3, right when my daughter was born back in 2018, but we're hopeful to be a family of 4 down the road. So that's why I'm still working part-time at this point. We should be at our family of 4 fire number in early 2021. It might be a little sooner than that, depending on what these markets do, but I'm very conservative. And at a 3% growth, wow, we would be there in 2021 at my part-time job. So even working part-time, we still have a 50% savings rate, but that's all because of this lifestyle we live, right? Of like not spending a lot of money. So it wasn't hard for us to make this change. It's like, I have so much time off and this is just going to be such a great way to transition into early retirement for me that it's just like, it was a no-brainer.
I want to track actually how you're, I know you're very transparent with your numbers and we'll come back to that in just a second, but I just want to stay here. If you'll give me just one more second here to talk about this kind of zone of awareness idea. So the crazy thing is when you pick a profession and you're on the path to financial independence, there's the spend less side, which you guys are crushing. And then there's the earn more side. If you do both together, everything goes faster. And you're not working in a career forever. You're doing it for a relatively short period of time if you can optimize both sides of those equations. And you've just laid out a situation where you're going to work less than one third of the year and you're crushing your path to financial independence, albeit in something that you probably couldn't do forever. That's very interesting to me. And I'm curious, one, you have a master's degree. So is what you're doing, would that require a master's degree, really? And then two, I want to respect the fact that you're in this role currently, but at the same point, could you give our audience an idea of the range for pay of what someone might expect to be fair and competitive in this type of industry that you're in?
Yeah, sure. So I don't think you need a master's degree. I don't think many of my coworkers have a master's degree. And I don't even think you need an economics and or math degree for this. Everything I learned was on the job, like especially energy related, trading related. It was all on the job learning. I'd say you'd need some sort of bachelor's degree to probably get seen if you have something in the energy field, you know, that or concentration, you know, that would probably be a pro, but it's definitely not required by any sense. In terms of compensation, when I first started the rotation program right out of my master's, I was making $69,000. After those 18 months, and when I started this trader position, I was making somewhere in the 70s. I got a little bump at that point, maybe 73, something like that. So that was my entry-level real-time trader position. When I left as a full-time employee there, well, actually, I'll just tell you, right now as a part-time employee, 50%, I'm making $56,000 base. So if I was to go up back to full-time, which I have the option to, I just never plan on doing it, I would be around $112,000. That's base. Typically, the bonus, it can range depending on the year, how well your team does, how well the floor does, how well the company does. The company I work for now, the range in salary is anywhere between 30 to 50% of your salary.
Yeah, I'm so struck by this shift working as like a nice transition to FI, because it sounds like you hit FI for your family of three in 2018. By the sound of it, you're making 56,000 base and you're still saving more than 50%. So therefore you could cut your, whatever it was, 73 days that you're working in a year, probably down to 30 and cover your entire yearly expenses. Like, is that something you're contemplating? Is this a job in the sense that you're describing the shift work as when you're off the clock, you're off the clock. When you're there, you're filling those hours that your employer needs. Could you work as few as 30 days in a year? Could you work as few as 20 days? Or is there like a minimum where they say, all right, Court, let's be reasonable here. It's not worth our time.
This is pretty much it. I'm in a very unique situation. There's not really part-time roles in the energy field. At least no one I've ever interacted with has ever been part-time. I essentially kind of created this role, again, because thanks to the power of FI.
Oh, wow. Well, that's it. I mean, you got to tell us that story. Tell us. I mean, that's what this power is all about.
But well, you've seen it, right? I mean, I don't want to shortcut it. We're going to find your story. But like when the employer needs you more than you need them, or rather when you no longer need the job, you get to make sometimes what would seem to an outsider as an unreasonable request and get it.
Exactly. So I was working for a different company, like I said, doing the Monday through Friday grind, right? Not as a trader anymore. I was doing development. So it was very early stage, boots on the ground, required a ton of travel. And I was away from my family way too much considering how close we were to our family of four fire number. Like I didn't need that job that bad, right? For the travel to be that insane. So that's ultimately what led me to go back to shift work. And so I essentially reached out to my old boss because one of my coworkers who was on the desk on as a shift worker with me, she had some health issues. And so she was only working part-time herself. And the other half of her shifts were being covered by other people on the desk who were getting paid overtime. And this had been going on since before I left. So about 3 years plus that had been going on. And that was kind of the standard. I knew that they were paying overtime to my coworkers, essentially my old coworkers, right? And so I reached out to my boss and said, hey, would you be willing to consider having me fill in the other half of her shifts? And I would come on as a part-time salaried employee and cover those shifts. And I knew what I was getting paid in the past. You know, I knew what I was getting paid now, and I was able to negotiate my salary. And my boss told me, he's like, okay, don't tell anyone else on the desk this, but if you were to go to full time and double your salary, essentially, you would be the highest paid person out of our 11 person team. I am not the most senior person. There are people there have been doing this for 20 years, you know, but that is just the power of all of this. Is I thought to reach out to my boss. Now, it actually wasn't me. It was my wife, Nick. She came up with this genius plan.
the master scheme.
Let's give credit where credit's due, right? She was so frustrated with all the travel just as much as me, because she was essentially solo parenting, which was not part of our plans at all. You know, like, we worked this hard to be there for our daughter. And I just felt like I was so distracted and so far away from my family that it just was not going the right way, even though, like, essentially, if I would have kept working full time for 8 more months, we would have reached our family of four fire number. But it wasn't worth those 8 more months of that grind. It was for both of us. We had this realization that's like, why rush to this end goal when it's just a made up end goal? Why not make it a much smoother, more enjoyable path where we're all happier? And I'm hardly working now, so I don't even feel like I'm working, to be honest. But we're like gliding into this end goal of our family of four fire date. And like on top of that, to switch kind of to the Canadian pro, I'll talk like on the Canadian side here for a minute, is now with this slower time frame or this longer time frame with me working full time, we're essentially aiming for us to reach our family of four fire number when hopeful baby two is born. And with that, I'll be able to take advantage of Canada's very generous parental leave. So essentially what's going to happen is once I do leave, once baby number two is hopefully born, I'll be on 18 months of paid parental leave. So I'll still have all of my employer sponsored benefits for health coverage, which we can dig into that later if you want. We're also getting paid by the government. It's not my full salary by any means, but we will be getting about $25,000 over that 18 month period after taxes.
So from a sequence of return risk perspective, exactly, that's a pretty significant glide path.
Exactly.
Right there.
So that's, you know, going to funnel and fund our first year of early retirement, thanks to the Canadian government.
Wow. I'm kind of speechless. What a plan. I love that.
Let's talk about that fire number. So tell me like what your life actually costs, what number you had in mind, and how long it took you from basically you and Nick combining your finances to get there.
Starting off was I was at negative 70,000. She was at negative 40,000, right? Over the course of 9 years is basically how long it took for us to not only pay off that debt, but reach our millionaire status. We started that, for me, it was in 2008. For her, it was 2013, I believe, when she finished her second degree. Over that time frame, up until end of 2019, let's say, we're now sitting at about $1.2 million. Currently, we're only spending about $25,000. So using the 4% rule, you know, we're way past our number, essentially. I am very, very, very fiscally conservative with things. So our projected fire number, we're projecting it to be a bit higher. We're using a $35,000 number there. So again, with the 4% rule, that puts us at about $875,000. I don't include our house value. I don't include our car value because those are not bringing in any income, right? So just in terms of passive income, $875,000. But we're actually going to be closer to a 2% safe withdrawal rate or safe withdrawal.
Yep. When it Big Earn is smiling somewhere, believe me.
Exactly. Yeah. He'd be very happy with us. I read his whole series.
We need to get like a Big Earn, big thumbs up overlay on the YouTube channel. Like,
Bigger and approved.
Yeah. So essentially how we're getting there is twofold. We're targeting an 875,000 passive income number, and we're just shy of that. We're about $830,000 right now in terms of our overall net worth is in passive income. Mostly in, well, it's all in index funds. We're big VTSAX fans for our money in the States, and we invest in VUN.to for our Canadian accounts. But essentially how we're targeting $875,000, which would correlate to a 4% rule, but we're really only getting down to a 2% is twofold. So we have the first thing is geo-arbitrage. A majority of our investments are in US dollars. I was working in the US for the majority of my working career. A lot of the investments over the years that have grown there are all in US dollars. It's about 70-30 split. About 70% of our investment portfolio is in US currency. The other 30% is in Canadian. But I don't view it as the two different currencies and do the exchange rate now. I just look at them all as one set number. Just what does the account read? And then when it comes time to actually withdrawing, you know, then we're going to be withdrawing US currency, but spending Canadian currency because our plan long-term is to live and stay up here. And so that exchange rate is about 1.3 to 1.35%. We're basically getting a bump of 30 to 35% returns on all of our US investments. So that basically brings us down by a percentage point in our safe withdrawal rate. The other half to the story is a benefit to living in Canada. So there's what's called the Canada Child Benefit. Every family is eligible for it. It's just income dependent. And when I was working full time, when our daughter was one, we were getting about $1,000 a year from it. Now that I'm working part time and earning about $56,000 base, we get about $5,000. This is after tax money for families to use. Once we retire and we're no longer earning any sort of income, we'll get the max, which depending on their age, when they're six and under, it's right now it'll change. Of course, every year it changes, but right now it's about $6,600 a year after tax that a family would get. For any child that's 6 to 17, it's about $5,600. So it's a little less as a child gets older. Weighted average, you're sitting at right around $6,000 a year, basically that we would be getting per child from the government. So that's about $12,000 a year that we will be getting after tax from the government to spend.
Oh my goodness.
So with our, you know, annual expense of $35,000, that $12,000 plays a big role, right? So that's essentially like another percentage down in our safe withdrawal, like by getting this money from the government. We're sitting, I think, I want to say it's like 1.96% safe withdrawal rate when you factor those two things in. I did the math a while ago.
Oh, but what about health insurance?
Oh, yes, health
but
insurance.
Wait, there's more.
Let's think of this as me, the American, right, coming up to Canada. We moved up here in 2015. We took 6 months off to travel, leaving Florida, selling everything, literally everything except for a couple bags that we each owned and decided of things we wanted to keep, and moved up here, and we traveled around Europe for a bit. Anyways, we come up here. I've got three health insurance related stories. I start my first Canadian job with a Canadian employer and you're signing up for your benefits. Okay. So the health benefits come up. I honestly had to go back and forth on the screen because you select if you're doing an individual or a family for your insurance. I selected family. At this point, it was Nick and I. Finn wasn't in the picture. So I selected family and it was saying you were going to get paid more because you have more people that need this coverage. And I was like, no, no, this must be wrong. I should be paying more because I have more people that need coverage. Right? So I honestly was going back and forth. We had like, essentially it was like a flex spending. They put you in the top tier health coverage. If you opt to go down to a lower tier, you got flex spending basically put back into your paycheck. And so they were saying, since you're a family, you get more money put back into your paycheck. And I was like, this does not make any sense to me. So that was one thing. The other thing when I was signing up for my benefits is everything here I've learned is very much preventative and proactive. So with my employer sponsored insurance, every person within my family every year gets $500 to spend on massage, gets $500 to spend on chiro, gets $500 to spend on physio, gets $500 to spend on nutritionist, dietitian, speech language pathologist. I mean, you name it, you think of whatever specialty, each person in my family gets $500 a year to spend on that. And that's per category. It's not overall combined.
What?
It's like, Yeah. So it's just insane. Again, I'm like, whoa, 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 what do I get? So this is like extra from my employer, right? So without that, there's what's called, you know, universal healthcare here. You pay for it in your taxes. Everyone, you know, from the US thinks we're paying 50% taxes. Like, we're not. We pay a little bit more. I think right now, I think my taxes are about, I'm in the 18% tax bracket because I get these flexible spend back. I think if I opted for the best healthcare coverage, I would be around low 20s, like 21 or 22% average tax. So it's not like I'm sitting at a 50% tax margin, you know, marginal tax rate. But anyways, regardless if you're employed or not, you have access to your doctor, your general doctor. You go, you get covered, you go see them, you leave when all is said and done. You leave. There's no deductible. There's no copay. There's no nothing. Like, you just go to your doctor. I mean,
it, in theory, it sounds so boring. It sounds so simple and easy. Why? It sounds horrible.
I mean, I was listening to your RIP medical debt episode. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm so glad I never, ever, ever, ever have to deal with anything like this ever again. Same goes, you know, for emergency services. If you're in the hospital for whatever reason, you go to the ER, you're there for however long, you leave. They see you, they treat you. And when all is said and done, you leave. So at first you're like, no way, that cannot, that there's got to be some sort of payment or something that I'm missing. Well, I've got two, like, real world, this actually happened to us. You know, back in 2016, I was in a car accident. A guy had a stop sign, never stopped, ran right through that and just totaled my car completely. Airbags, you know, car was towed and it was just totally done for. I ended up just breaking my elbow when all was said and done. I had pretty severe whiplash, but I spent all day at the urgent care. They were doing x-rays, you know, looking for any sort of internal bleeding, all this stuff. But with an elbow, they don't want you to cast it because they don't want it to freeze. So I was in a sling for a couple weeks. The doctors there were like, just so you know, you're going to go home with the sling, but it's not covered through Alberta Health. So you're going to get a bill for $18. Are you okay with that? I was like, yeah. So I was like, are you serious? Like, I was literally there all day long. They were doing all these studies and I get an $18 bill mailed to me. I was like,
I knew there was a catch.
Yeah, right. So that's one story. The other one, I was in between jobs. I was switching from my full-time position to this part-time position with a different company, right? My wife has been retired at this point for over a year, year and a half. So she's not getting any sort of an extra employer sponsored benefits either. So neither one of us had any sort of employer benefits. And on the Saturday before I was supposed to start my new job on Monday, my wife wasn't feeling well. She wasn't feeling well for a couple of weeks leading up to this, but by that Saturday it was getting worse. She went into the ER. Turns out she ended up having meningitis, which is pretty severe if anyone's never heard of it. She was immediately put in isolation and lockdown, and she was there overnight in the hospital for 5 nights while they were doing all these different studies, right? Just determining which kind and all the stuff. When all was said and done, we leave. We just leave the hospital. We walk to the car and we're on our merry way. I think I spent $35 in parking over those 5 days when I would go and visit her. You know, that was our expense. Wow. To deal with meningitis. And I'm not saying it's perfect. Like, it's definitely not perfect. But from an American standpoint, I'm just like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, absolutely amazing, you know? And so in our fire plans, we're planning to have supplemental coverage because part of this universal plan covers, you know, doctors and hospitals and visits, things like that. But it doesn't cover dental and vision and prescription. Although there's been talk about universal pharmacare in the most recent election. So I think it's going to get there. So I'm not worried about it going the opposite way. If anything, I think later down the road, we'll have more and more coverage for us. But we are factoring that supplemental insurance into our fire calculations too. So that way we have dental and vision and prescription in there. But the health system here is amazing. Like, having our child here, we didn't have to think of any sort of pregnancy related costs. Like, there is nothing. And I know in the States, you know, it can cost depending on your insurance and your coverage and everything. And if you've met your deductible or not and all yada yada, you know, you might end up only paying X to have your child, you know, I don't know.
Jonathan, right? Is crying right now.
Crying's the wrong term. Weeping silently.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So
Yes. All right. Don't rub it in anymore. But I do. This isn't really a tax episode. I don't even really want to make it go super in the weeds with the taxes here. I think we could probably dedicate an episode to Canadian taxes because I know we have a significant Canadian audience. But I am curious, just to circle back to it, because I know you have Canada and then you have provinces. And since you said 18%, just at a very high macro level, Canada, they have marginal tax brackets. Do you have provincial tax as well as what you would have, you know, at the Canadian level? Like, for our audience, is it a flat tax, marginal tax? And how is this going to affect you with someone with a significant amount of wealth as you go into your drawdown?
Yeah, sure. So it's marginal taxes here, and there are provincial taxes as well. Where we are in Alberta, there's no additional provincial tax, similar to like Washington State or Florida. But I think every other province, I believe, has a provincial tax. So we kind of lucked into that. We didn't realize that when we moved here. We just wanted to move here because it was so beautiful and we were in love with the Canadian Rockies. And then the added bonus was no provincial tax as well. So there is a provincial tax, just not in Alberta. So that helps us to keep us at a low tax bracket. In terms of our strategy in regards to taxes up here, the recent elections, the Liberals were reelected, and there's a federal basic limit, a federal basic amount of income that you can withdraw tax-free. And it's now been increased to $15,000 per person. So essentially, we are going to be withdrawing $25,000 a year because the rest is going to be coming from that Canada Child benefit. So of that $25,000 that we're going to be withdrawing, we're not subject to tax on it at all. We also, again, have a lot of our accounts in our US dollars. So we're going to be withdrawing that first, where we won't pay the capital gains. We're utilizing, you know, the tax efficiencies in the US first in our taxable accounts. And then we're going to shift over to our tax advantage accounts in Canada, which is the RRSP, a registered retirement savings plan, and which is like a 401k. Similar in the States, and a TFSA, tax-free savings account, which is like a Roth IRA. Both of those, like, there are no tax penalties at all. I know with the 401k, you have to do the Roth conversion ladder and you pay taxes and yada, yada. With the RRSP, you can withdraw at any time penalty-free. So the tax advantage accounts in Canada are similar, but I think they're actually quite a few benefits in comparison to the US tax advantage accounts. And I have a whole investing series on our blog that digs into the US accounts and the Canadian accounts. So I won't dig into it too much here unless...
No, that's perfect. In fact, we will direct people to your site. Let's go ahead and do that now. Someone is listening to this. They want to find out about more about you and your family story. They want to connect with you. What is the best way to find out more about what you guys are doing?
Sure. So we can either be contacted or found on our blog, which is www.modernfamily.com. It's like a spin on Modern Family.
I see what you did there. Yep. And we'll have that linked up in the show notes as well for today's episode.
Great. Yeah. And the other way that we can get contacted is through our Instagram, which is also at Modern Family. That's kind of the only social media we're on.
Modern Family. Rolls right off the tongue. All right. Now, on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But Cord, on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I am ready.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Court, question number one. What is your favorite blog, podcast, or book of all time?
So it's hard for me to name just one, so deal with me here, if you don't mind. It all started with Mr. Money Mustache, so I've got to give credit where credit's due. Of course, he's kind of like the godfather in my mind in terms of the FIRE movement. We also really love Mad Scientist, J.L. Collins, Frugal Woods, and Millennial Revolution. They're another Canadian blog out there for any Canadians listening. We love the Safe Withdrawal Rate series from Early Retirement Now. Love his overall blog. He goes into so many details on the numbers. I know you guys have had him on a couple times. The Frugal Woods wrote a great post called The Joy That Comes When Less Is Enough. That's a great blog post. There's also, of course, the Shockingly Simple Math behind Early Retirement, the classic there, of course. In terms of books, we really love, you know, Your Money or Your Life and The Simple Path to Wealth. Those would be our go-to. Some other great ones are Goodbye Things, The Story of Stuff, Millionaire Teacher, and Digital Minimalism. In terms of our podcasts, of course, we love you guys. We love Afford Anything, Fire Drill, Millionaires Unveiled, and Explore FI Canada. I know I just rattled off a whole ton. I know.
I have never heard anybody reference awesome. Word. They're all great, huge fans, but way to really push the limits on what you can communicate.
I know.
On that, as
there's
an
no
to that
one
question.
For me, but we did put on our blog, we have our favorite fire resources. So no need for anyone to like scribble all that down really quick. Just head to our blog. It's all there for you. So I know I rattled a lot. Sorry.
You want me to just say one? What?
Yeah, I can't.
Here's
do that.
20.
It's kind of like me, Brad. Yeah. All right. Question number two. An inflection point in your life that was especially memorable or meaningful?
I'd have to say the biggest one was becoming a parent. I mean, we knew we wanted to be involved parents, and that was the driving force behind FIRE over these last few years. But I didn't really know like how much love you can actually feel for another human until our daughter was actually born. So we're both so grateful to be in the situation that we're in, where all we want to do is spend time with her, and we're able to. So we're so grateful for that.
Yeah, I think that was one of my big personal wins this year, was just the amount of time I get to spend with my kids. It's amazing. It's a real blessing.
Yeah.
All right, Corey, question number three, your favorite life hack?
Being genuine, like kind and grateful. Having these qualities really does go a long way in life. And also figuring out how to live life on your own terms and breaking free from how society says you should be living your life. There's no cost to being genuine and kind, and ultimately, it helps you create the true community of people who you trust, and vice versa. So as for being grateful, there are so many people in the world who are worse off than you. Like literally billions of people live on less than $6 a day. So if you're listening to this, then you're in a place of privilege simply by having access to the internet. It's always easy to compare your life to others out there, especially with social media and the addiction to smartphones and everyone showing their highlight reel, you know, which is not real life. So imagine if people living on $6 a day were posting pictures nonstop on Instagram. It just doesn't happen, right? So instead, we're bombarded with the glitz and glamour of celebrities, but we're masked from the harsh realities many people face day in and day out around the world. So really grounding yourself is key, and it truly helps with the mindset shift that's needed to figure out how to live life according to your own values and versus what society is constantly trying to bombard you with via marketing and advertising.
Yeah, Cord, I completely hear you about being genuine. That's one of my most, I guess, transformative life hacks as well. And it sounds so silly to call it a life hack, right? But just being a kind human being, caring about people, asking questions, being genuine, it really does go a long, long way. So yeah, I love that.
All right, question number four, the biggest financial mistake you've made.
I'll preface this by saying it's more of a missed opportunity than a mistake. And as much as I don't want to admit it, it's probably paying off our student loans and mortgages early, as weird as that sounds. What I mean is that we likely could have made a lot more money by throwing that excess income into the market in index funds over those years. So it was early 2009 to mid-2011 for the student loans, and then mid-2011 to 2015 for the down payment and then the mortgage payoff, right? But there's no way to predict what the market's going to do then. And we hated having debt hanging over us, and we wanted it gone ASAP for the psychological and emotional side of things, right? So if I could have gone back in time, I likely would still do the same thing. But for others listening, you know, it may be worthwhile to look at the numbers behind paying off your different kinds of debt while also figuring out what type of person you are when it comes to personal finances. You know, you need to be in tune with your risk appetite and level of aversion to debt. Of course, the market took off during that time frame, but that's obviously me looking back in time, right? So it could have gone the complete other way, and I'd be looking like, you know, the biggest champion in the whole world here. So it's totally dependent on what the market's going to do, which is out of your hands. But, you know, our mortgage was low, and so we were aggressive paying that off, but I'd do it all over again.
Yeah, let me echo that and just add some numbers to that as well. So that's my story too. So finishing my pharmacy degree in 2013, from 2013 to 2017, making the choice to pay off $168,000 of student loan debt. So what am I? I'm paying a 6%. It's a 6% interest rate. I'm missing out on all the marginal tax bracket savings that I would have gotten. On top of that, by putting that money all towards tax deferred vehicles, the market just went straight up 15% plus year over year for those 4 years. Clearly a financial mistake. But let me tell you this. If I had done exactly what we described, if I had not prioritized paying off my debt, ChooseFI does not exist. There is no ChooseFI. The only reason we're having this conversation now is because I prioritized paying off debt. And you don't know what the market's going to do, but you can lock in that freedom that paying off that debt provides you. And so financial mistake, maybe. Life mistake, absolutely not.
Totally agree.
All right. Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
Say that there's no one else looking after you and your career as much as you are. So ensure that you're living the life that your future self would be proud of. And that's not just regarding the financial side of things, but also in regards to your friendships and relationships with others, you know, your health, your impact on the world. Just be proactive and think about the life you want to live in 10 years and start working on that today. In regards to your career, there's no one else more in tune with your career path than yourself. So if you feel you're at a point in which you deserve a raise, you need to smartly approach that subject with your boss or employer rather than wait on the sidelines for them to bring it up to you.
And we do have a bonus question for you. What purchase have you made over the past 12 months that has brought the most value to your life?
As odd as it sounds, it has to be my essential oil diffuser. It just sets the tone for a relaxing morning and brings me good vibes. I think it costs about $20, and each bottle of oil is like $3 or $4, and it lasts for such a long time. It was just that ambiance and that calming feeling that it provides me with was well worth the purchase.
And you're at home 300 out of 365 days.
Exactly. So I'm getting my use out of it for sure.
Do we have any fan favorite oils? What are we talking about here?
I use either peppermint or lavender. Those are kind of my go-to.
Yeah.
Brad, I have a diffuser downstairs. You can sample my wares.
Yeah, if you've got lavender, I'm in.
Yeah, there we go. All right, Court, thanks so much for coming on the show. This has been amazing.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
All right, my friends, if you got value from today's episode, and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take a second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. And I mean, that could be podcast, it could be on Apple, it could be Stitcher. Maybe you're watching our YouTube station, in which case, ring that bell, hit that subscribe button. Just lets the platform know that you want to be here when we produce additional content. Also, if you heard Court's incredible story and you're like, well, how do I get started on my path to financial independence? We have created an illustrated guide to find. This is by far the simplest way to find out these big levers that you can take action on and really start building out your own blueprint to financial independence. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/start. Get started today. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.